You just have to keep going. You have to want it enough to wake up tomorrow and do the same thing over.
This was me being a hustler.
The only way that I've gotten to this point in my life is to try to treat people the way I want to be treated.
Welcome to Ground Zero Growth with your host, Sam Sapp, owner of Lockbaud.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ground Zero Growth. I'm joined today with my guest, Mark Davis, owner of Steel Glide. How are you doing today, Mark?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. My pleasure. So kind of take a moment before we get too far into it and explain Steel Glide and what it is that's captivated your focus currently.
Oh, so Steel Glide, formerly TransLube Lubricants, it's a family business. My mom and dad founded that in 1975. He bought the rights off of his employer, and I didn't know the first thing about it other than it was dad's company, and he told me stuff to do, and I did it, right? And you know, I've had people before say, you know, I really respect your work ethic. I'm like, no, that was dad's work ethic. I had an obedience ethic. So dad worked me in the business, and I did what he told me. And it paid for some college educations for his kids and retirement and all the rest of that. But then mom passed away, and then dad. And my sister and I looked at each other, and we ultimately decided, all right, well, I'm going to do it. And that was about a year and a half ago now. So we've been running, figuring things out. It's a lot different being in the house with it versus having to actually run it. So I've learned a lot about the specifics of the company over the past year and a half, things that I didn't pick up, but it's a passion to me because it is a family business, and I intend to leave it to my kids, assuming that they want to do something with it. I'm specifically working on it to pass it along.
That's fair. Now, do you have some marketing experience? Because frankly, the first thing that comes to my mind is TransLube Lubricants to Steel Glide. That's a bit of a transition.
It is. And, you know, I have to be completely transparent here. It got to the point where you call people and you say, I'm from TransLube, and they would laugh. They would straight up giggle. TransLube, what are you selling, dude? Come on. Give me a break.
Effective, though, too? You'd have their ear at that point.
You never know. You never know who you're reaching, right? So, you also ended up occasionally with some really weird Google results.
No doubt.
How about no?
You know, different lead or two probably every now and again that bothered to call in. Just like, I think you got the wrong.
Yeah, it's needed to change for a while. It actually carries part of its name from the original company that created the first formula, which, by the way, was not great. Dad's revised the formula three times. So the whole experience has been pretty amazing end to end, start to finish. Being in charge, deciding to rebrand. It's a 50-year-old company. So changing the name is kind of a big deal. I thought about it for quite some time. I'd already been talking to Dad about it before he passed away, and Dad didn't like change. He didn't want to do anything, very wisely, didn't want to do anything he didn't completely understand. And he didn't understand marketing and rebranding, so he didn't want to do it. Well, now we've done it, and it's so far it's come off pretty well. Although, man, it's complicated to change a company name across all of the government and private entities that you have to deal with. There's always somebody now that shows up, you know, just out of the blue and says, oh, you want to change your name? Here, fill out these forms in triplicate. It's like, oh, come on.
You're not kidding. That's always an interesting burden for sure. Anytime I have an idea now, it's like, well, is there any way that could be like a spinoff brand or something? Let's kind of minimize opening up another entity if we can help it. So, but I'll tell you what. So what's going through my head on the first line of questioning. So before we started, we were just talking about the prior podcast recording, which was Christian Brim, and we were discussing connection between businesses and ownership and almost a connectivity of like one's baby a little bit, essentially, and that connection to it. And now we're talking about rebrand. Can you kind of tell me about how this has been for you psychologically and emotionally? You know, you're taking, well, the other thing that's going through my head, to be honest, is my dad and his instilling of work ethic. And I still remember, you know, I'll probably never forget it. I don't know how I should call him up and tell him this, but there was a time when we were shoveling snow and we made the decision to shovel the neighbor's snow. I think she was a little bit elderly or something. Don't recall much about the neighbor specifically, but I remember dad had made the decision that, hey, we're going to go shovel this neighbor's driveway and we're not going to get paid anything for it. And I don't recall doing a particularly lackluster job or not, but I do recall dad, you know, we got done and dad goes, okay, now I need you to look at your work. Now, is this something that you can put your name behind, this driveway? You know, free or not, this is your work. This is who you are. This is how you present yourself. Now, is this how you want to be presented? And frankly, you know, with that degree of white, I think I did redo the driveway. I again, don't fully remember. I just remember that sat. And frankly, I think it's probably going to stick with me for the rest of my life. But so this is your family's work, your father's work that he held closely. How has it been kind of coming in and changing the name and some of that stuff? Is there an extra degree of weight from maybe some of the other businesses that I've known you founded? And we could talk more about that later, but.
Because it had mom and dad's handprints on it, because it's had their decisions over the decades, I do check myself before I make substantial decisions, because I want to try to put myself back into the mindset that mom and dad had when they made those decisions originally. I don't want to just assume, you know, this is the next generation, we're the new guard. We know all the right things to do. Stand back. I got this. Hold my beer. No. My mom and dad ran this thing successfully for 50 years. I'm not just going to wander in off the street and suddenly make it better. So I've been much more careful and circumspect in setting strategy and direction for this company than I have been with my other companies. Because, you know, honestly, it was my original vision. It was my original creation. So the only person I had to touch base with was me. And it was a whole lot easier.
What is it like finding those fingerprints? You know, like now, even after the fact, right? Finding that document or reviewing that, you know.
Yeah, I got to admit, you know, it's still kind of fresh. Mom's been gone 5 years, dad about a year and a half. And sometimes I'll run across, you know, their handwriting, run across their notes, and it chokes me up because I'm working on something. I'm carrying something forward that they worked much of their lives on. And they specifically did it so that they could care for their family. Dad didn't do it out of ego. He didn't do it out of some creator's drive to, you know, make a dent in the universe or whatever it was that Jobs said. Dad was just trying to take care of his family and his kids. And he did an excellent job. I should do so well. I try, and I measure myself against my dad all the time. I try. Am I doing as well as him? I don't know. I'm doing different. We'll see. I think I can make it bigger. I don't know that I can make it better.
Well, to that end, I'm already wondering, is there a degree of change you think that has to happen? I mean,
yeah.
For it to be yours, but not just yours, like it's different, like you changed everything, yours like... You know, for me to take over from my dad to then try to be my dad, that I don't think that would pan out well. I think that would be setting myself up for failure personally. And that's not what you're saying you're doing, but that's why I'm asking, is there a degree of change that you think is necessary just for you to really take it on as yours, but also still being, and I guess that's the juggle.
It is. Yeah. It's a delicate, balance, a tricky little mind game to play. But the reality is, my dad was quite expert at this company. And in many ways, he was quite expert at life. So I check in from time to time with dad's memory, have little conversations with him. You know, it's not like I think he's, you know, sitting in the chair next to me, but, you know, I'm interacting with the man that I remember. And he speaks to me from my memory, you know, not some, you know, unusual spiritual crystal rubbing kind of thing. Just dad's memory, continuing to have an impact on me. But I do, in a way, I do kind of personify it. You know, I'll have a conversation essentially with myself.
Well, and I think the part of the reason, so where this questioning is coming from for me is I'm kind of channeling. So my wife's stepdad was probably one of the most I don't know. I wish I had some way to catalyze his memory in words right now, but I'm really struggling with that. Just kind of like the friendliest person. And, you know, their family used to kind of talk about, you know, moments where it's like, you're having to fix something or do something and you're like, dang it, you know, why'd you do it this way? And, you know, a good example is I'm putting this thing up and he's got this way up and this way down, and you end up learning the hard way he must have clearly mislabeled it, because I had to turn it around and only then did it fit perfect. And I had to do, it took a solid hour to get it the way around before. And I'm over there kind of like, dang it, what are you doing? Why? But all in love. That was the other weird thing. It's like I'm teasing him, you know. From, and then what was even more interesting is, and this is the bit I'm really kind of interested to tie into you, if you've seen some of this stuff. I wish I could explain, because I used to kind of think it was just weird and unrelated. You know, I could have swore to get this thing upright, I needed so many screws, and I did not have those. And I'm like 99.99%. I counted, right? Like, I did not have those screws. And to the point to where, you know, my wife or mom, they're off looking for them, right? And again, I'm kind of having, to your point, this conversation with him, a little bit teasing. And I finally get to the point to where I need the final two screws or whatever that I do not have. And I go to reach just kind of habitually, and all of a sudden they're there. Those screws are there. And I'm over here like, and the excuse I tell everybody is I miscounted, but I'm also humble enough to say, look, I'm pretty sure I counted right the first time. Obviously I didn't, but I'll also say that, like, if there was ever a moment where I'm over here too, even thinking somehow, whatever, he's watching over, whatever you want to say, right. I don't even know, but
what happened?
Well, because I'm going to my wife, like, where'd you find the extra screws? And she's like,
where'd you find my screws?
I was like, no. I was like, and so anyway, okay, so what I don't know. I don't know what the question there is. Have you had a moment where you're having that conversation and you're sure you got some insight, you know, or something happened? That phone rang.
Yeah. Insight, yes. Do I think it was something unusual, metaphysical, spiritual? I don't know, right? I mean, at bottom, I'm a scientist, I'm an engineer at heart, but I still have to accept and, you know, give a hat tip to, what was it? Lewis called it the numinous, right? The thing bigger than me. The sense of profundity about the universe and my tiny part in it. yeah, stuff like that can happen. I believe it happens. I don't know if I've experienced it, but sometimes it seems like it. I'll have, a thought that comes to me with clarity that really feels more like a dad thought than a Mark thought. When I'll have, I'll have just a sudden sense of, you know, warmth or comfort. You know, sometimes I think maybe that's Mom, but I don't know. I like to entertain those ideas, but I don't try to, you know, in any way convince other people of what's going on. That's just my experience.
Well, I agree. It's been a particularly weird one for me in tech in particular. I make the joke, anybody that isn't a little superstitious in tech just hasn't been in it long enough. And I feel like I even semi-confirmed. I was texting a buddy of mine the other day who's like the least superstitious person on the planet. And I was having some back and forth because he and I like to rub each other. And now that he's been in tech now since, I mean, you know, we jumped in about the same time and I kind of, you know, it didn't take me but a year before I was like, oh, careful what you say. You'll get what you ask for. And then, it took him a little bit longer, but he basically all out said he's superstitious now, too. He just didn't want to use that phrasing. He was like, oh, yeah, weird things happen all the time that you can't explain in tech. And I was like, yeah, that's what superstition is.
Funny story. There was... you know, this is back when I was doing telecommunications network programming, and we were joking about one of the vendors that was having such a hard time getting their systems to work. And naturally, all of our stuff was awesome that day. So we felt very superior. And, somebody said, yeah, I just got off the phone with them. I kid you not, the guy said that they were in the back laying hands on the server. And then everybody started laughing. How ridiculous is that? And when everybody quieted down, I asked, have you guys ever really been in a software jam? Because I'd lay hands on a server in a minute if I thought it would do anything to help. In fact, I might do that next time.
You get desperate. In a big enough jam, people, what's wild to me is in a big enough jam, I've seen people, like even myself in some cases, start spitballing out things that make absolutely no sense, but then that triggers something in somebody that does understand what's going on underneath, like some random analogy or something. Like I remember I was having this weird network thing. And again, this has literally happened both ways. It's been me too. But in this case, in the example I'm given, this other guy had zero clue what was going on. He started giving some baseball analogy. I have zero clue what it was. And I am not a sports person. And I'm over here like, you know, that analogy is so far off, yet it's triggered. I think I know how to fix this now. And the next thing you know, I'm diving in and I'm fixing it. And I've done the same thing for other people where I'm like, well, have you tried this, 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 and this? And they're over there like, Sam, you have no clue what you're talking about. But thank you. I've fixed it now. So, and yeah. It wouldn't have happened without those random. So, yeah, it can get wild fast.
Yeah, we used to call that the cardboard cutout principle. So, you know, when you call somebody over to look at your problem, it wasn't because they actually knew anything. You just needed them to stand there so you could explain it to them. And in the explanation, you'd find what was wrong. And, you know, one guy, when I was doing that, one guy said, you know, all I need to do is just stand up a cardboard cutout of somebody over here and walk away and you'd figure this out. And I said, yeah, but I'm hard to fool. So you just stand there. We'll work on the cardboard cutout thing later. But then one of our team members actually went and purchased a Hulk Hogan life-size. This thing was huge. Life-size Hulk Hogan. And so then anytime you had a bug and you couldn't get it fixed, somebody would invariably come and put Hulk Hogan in your office. So that was a little bit of commiseration, but also kind of making fun of you.
So I love this, and I'm stealing that sentiment, cardboard cutout principle, because we have one called like second set of eyes, where you just sometimes you need somebody. This is what's interesting is typically what ends up happening with second set of eyes, in my experience, is it's inevitably, it doesn't have to be senior tech, it could be a junior tech. Somebody comes up, they look at it, and they're like, "Have you tried turning it off and on again?" And you've been so like down the rabbit hole of the ones right. and the zeros that you're like,
wait a minute.
That's the wait one thing minute. I didn't try. thank you. But what you just want to talk about, they call it now, and I might be getting it wrong. I'm not a developer, but I've been don't fault me. But in some of my spare time, sometimes back in the day during COVID, I would watch developers live stream programming. And now what they do is they get a duck, a rubber duck, and they explain to the rubber duck, same thing exactly.
When you're forced to actually explain it, you can stop your brain from fixing things that you didn't want it to fix. So one of the biggest problems in technology and engineering is that your brain really is trying to help you when it's making problems less apparent. So it's smoothing things over, right? My biggest problem in the refrigerator is if you move something 2 feet, it becomes invisible. I have got to find the stuff that I want all in the same place because my brain is trying to help me, but it won't see the stuff that's moved 2 feet. So, yeah, it's
interesting.
If you want to break through all the mind clutter and the self-deception and the self-justification, all the rest of that stuff around your work product, the easiest way is to have to explain it. That breaks down all of the assumptions that you've built up around the problem and really makes you say, oh, wait, I didn't turn the power on. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, I found it.
Yeah. Well, and I think, yeah, and it's, you know, and this all loops back to laying hands on the server. The interesting thing, I think that a lot of people, so it hits home a little bit because it makes me think about, we've been taking calls from people in crisis lately, and for lack of any better term, this is how I'm calling it. These are people that have been relatively hacked recently that have either had a lot of money stolen, had their agency taken away, you know, whatever it is. I mean, I've literally had a scenario now where I can have, it's upsetting. I finally hit this point in life where I don't need stories. I can draw from my own experiences. And this woman literally said, she's giving me permission to talk about it. She said, this was more psychologically jarring than stage 2 breast cancer. Because she lost her agency and the person was pretending to be her and then it was scamming other people. And sometimes I don't think. And the point on that is, you know, you were talking about how some people were judgmental, like why are they laying hands on the server? And it's like, I just don't know if enough people have experienced, and I hope enough people don't experience, right? That's kind of the point. Moments of crisis when something really, really, really bad has happened and your mind starts to play tricks on you where it's like, you know, a lot of when you're getting a call from a person in crisis, a lot of it is literally just trying to understand what's actually happening because that person at that point is practically manic for lack of any real better phrasing. And so you have to kind of parse through what's happening and then you have to discern what's one way versus the other way, because in their mind, it's all kind of been splashed together. But let's go back to kind of the traditional question. So now let's rewind the clock on you, Mark. We're just going to like, woo! So let's go back to kind of that high school period, right? Were you always going to inherit the family business? Was this just the, like, where are we at here in high school? Is the family business still going on? And what are your aspirations? You're about ready to go off to college. You're about ready to make a living for yourself. What's that look like?
I didn't have a thought for the family business other than, you know, it was what had become my parents' full-time work. I didn't have a thought for it. I wasn't really thinking all that far ahead, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old. Your mind, most people's minds don't go very far down the road. Mine didn't. I wasn't thinking about it that way. It was Dad's, and Dad had it, and he had always entertained the possibility of selling it. So I guess in my mind, I had that filed as he runs it and then he sells it, and I'll never have any interaction with it. Didn't turn out that way, and I'm happy for it. But yeah, that kid in high school, you know, I couldn't have run a lemonade stand, much less a company. I was much too impulsive. I'll say that.
So what was that first move? I was impulsive too. I was also a little bit of a communist, frankly, if we go back to that period.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I shudder to say it, but you know.
Yeah, I was, you know, a little bit naive in that way.
Right.
You know, if you're, you know, as I've heard it said before, I don't know who said it, but they say if you're young and you're not liberal, there's something wrong with you. And if you're grown and you're not conservative, see statement one, right? There's something wrong with you. But getting past the joke, as a young man, I was, you know, I was very liberal, very compassionate, still am. Honestly, it hasn't changed much. But I thought that, you know, somehow just through my very presence and actions, I was going to somehow make the world a great place. Didn't have the faintest idea how I might do that. I thought I would do that through, well, I thought the vehicle would be through writing, through the written word. That's what I thought I was going to do when I was in high school. And that's what everybody expected me to do. I went to an art school. I didn't go to a science school. We actually had to audition to get into the school. And the audition for a writer, obviously, is to show up with a portfolio of, you know, poetry, fiction, you know, opinion articles and all the rest of that. So that's where things were supposed to go. But then somebody made a mistake of showing me a computer once, and there we went. That became my obsession for the next, I don't know, what time is it? 40 years?
So tell me about it, though. So, okay, so you're going to school, you're going to be a writer. You're going to an art school because you're ready to start writing, right? You know, like Mark Twain, stuff like that. What books are you planning on writing, more out of curiosity? Like because you mentioned poems and whatnot, and what's captivated your fancy?
Southern Gothic. Huge fan of Southern Gothic. So Eudora Welty is probably my favorite author. Yeah, definitely my favorite author. Flannery O'Connor, and then Welty. They were so very interesting in the ways that they would write really sparse prose, but at the same time, they could, with great economy, they could spin an entire universe in a paragraph. It's just amazing simplicity. You look at the words and you think, oh, a child could do that. No, they can't. It's the way those words are employed that is the magic. And you know, everybody thought that's what I was gonna be doing, whether it was writing for art or for journalism. That's where I was supposed to end up. But again, you know, fell in love with computers, fell in love with programming. Software is creative anyway.
Who showed you the computer?
My dad bought it for me.
Okay.
So dad knew what he was doing. Dad would just drop things in your life, right? Just to see if you would take the bait. So he bought me a computer, and I became fascinated with that, but it was a bit underpowered.
and it didn't have a lot of accessories to it, a lot of software to it. So he went halves with me on another computer a few years later, and I put every penny I made into that machine for the next 10 years. Loved on it, upgraded it. There wasn't a part left in it except for the original motherboard from what I bought, because I had replaced absolutely everything. But it was fabulous. I learned so much on it. And, you know, Dad put me on a career path just by doing that. He didn't know what the career might look like, but he knew that computers were the next big thing. And if I got into it, then I'd be taken care of. And I sure was. It's been great.
And what did that end up doing for you then? So you went, you're going to college, you're going to be a company writer, your dad puts a computer in front of you. What is that first real job in computers then? And what was the lag period?
Yeah, I got a job almost immediately before I even got to engineering school. I spent some time kind of wandering between graduating from high school and ultimately ending up in engineering school. There's a lot of wasted time, a lot of dissipation. Not my best period, but it certainly built to a big change in my life, when I became a Christian at age 22. And that's when my clarity of purpose really congealed, really crystallized for me. I knew what I wanted to be. I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to write software. I didn't want to do anything else. Having fallen in love with software, I was blessed and fortunate that people paid money for that. I didn't do it for the money. I did it for the obsession. I get obsessed with a subject and I'll stay on it for, you know, years to decades, and then sooner or later I'm done with it. This one stuck. So I did software work across numerous industries, numerous technologies, some cool achievements, some, you know, people probably don't even know about. Well, nobody really knows. But it was not planned. It just unfolded. And I don't know if you've seen the movie, Peter Sellers' movie called Being There. He's Chance the Gardener. And all he knows how to do is garden. He's a savant. The only thing he can do is garden. His whole world is gardening. He's a gardener for a rich guy who passes away. And he lived in the rich guy's home. Well, now he's got nothing, right? But he does no gardening. So he just stumbles through the next several years of his life with great things happening. But all he does is talk about gardening, because that's all he knows, right? That's me. All I really knew was software and computers. So I kept talking about it. People kept paying me to do it. So that was terrific. But not a plan.
So you were doing all that consulting then? Is that safe to say? You were doing that solopreneur style, pay me and I'll make it?
Right. So I am the first company.
Okay.
Yeah. Army of one, right?
Okay.
And
word of mouth is how people are finding you. You design a killer app and somebody else says, oh, you got to talk to this Mark guy.
Yeah, that's the way it happens. Yeah, it's word of mouth. I don't have any way. I guess I probably could market myself, but then what would I do? I'm only one guy, right?
Sure.
I don't scale. So I can only handle one meal at a time. But the primary breadwinning activity for me was computer software, whether it was development, design, architecture, whatever it might be. That was the primary work product. And
so have you always kind of been in business for yourself from the family point on and the computer on? And
Yeah. So I've only been an employee for 3 years. This is post degree, right? I had lots of little jobs before I finished my degree, but post degree, I was only employee 3 years, period. Mm. And I've been out, 40 years. It's been a long time.
What was that 3-year period like? Was that just, you know, not for me, or was that?
Oh, it was
not
it was
for
cool.
me.
Yeah, it was cool, but the reality for me is I had to squeeze a lot of money out of a little BS degree. My wife is, we agreed that she would stay home and care for the children, and I would go out and make the money, you know, kind of the old traditional family model. But to do that required a lot of money, and it was hard to get there on the salaries of the time. But as a contractor, I got to make and then keep more money. And I've done that ever since. So thanks, Hughes Aircraft. That was a good kickoff. We did some cool stuff. And then I got to go out on my own.
Wow. That's pretty. Okay. That's some fascinating stuff. So how did you? Now, there's a lot there. I'm really trying to think through it all. So, like, because, you know, part of what I'm really trying to think through it all is this doesn't quite happen for everybody, right? Where it's just like, look, I'm developing, and then more people are referring me, and then I'm developing that stuff, and then I'm working through one thing at a time. Like you said, you know, it's just me. I couldn't handle more than one thing at a time. So you're obviously like charging enough for the one thing to spill over for a period of time into the next thing. Help me navigate all this. I mean, how do you know to charge enough for that thing and then the next thing? Because there's got to be a little bit of a lag period, right? How are you handling that lag period? And how are the individuals that you're working for so connected or influential that they're just passing you off to the next thing? You know what I mean? So how are you navigating those first 2 to 3 years of being a consultant where most folks it's feast or famine and the burnout rate, I think, is pretty substantial?
Yeah. So how do you navigate it? Well, all I knew was I had to make more money.
Sure.
And I learned it as I went. There's nothing like the tyranny of the imperative to get your attention and make you do stuff. And it was imperative that I make a lot of money. And it was also imperative that I weather any crises that might come along. So, yeah, you gotta take into account my net needs to be higher so that I can weather some downtime, some gaps between contracts. But, you know, my experience has been terrific. It's not reasonable to expect the degree of a busy that I've enjoyed through my career. I've only been without a gig 4 weeks ever. And that was uncomfortable, actually. I call it skydiving in the dark. You don't know where the bottom is. You don't know if you should pull the ripcord. You don't know what to do. It's just dark. But that's something that, with my faith, I had the confidence necessary to weather that particular gap. But 4 weeks without a job was eye-opening. Again, it's only happened once. Usually, I'll have a job that stacks right up on the current one, so that many times I'll finish one Friday and start one Monday.
Skydiving in the dark is a beautiful way of doing that. I had a previous interview likened it to entrepreneurship is going through a dark tunnel towards a light that you're not sure is the end of the tunnel or an oncoming train. An oncoming,
and you don't know how far away it is.
No, you don't. And so that's where I almost like skydiving in the dark better, because the ripcord analogy is the pivot, right? And it's so right. Wild to me. And I've never really gotten an answer to this question that I'm aware of. I've heard people elegantly describe, but none where I feel like I have an actual answer to if anybody asked this of me. It's like, where do you pivot? And it's really difficult for me to answer, because on one hand, you do need constant encouragement and like trudge on blindly. On the other hand, if you were to ask me, well, do I pull the cord at 4 weeks? Do I pull the cord at 6 weeks? Do I pull the cord at a month, year, multiple years? And it's like, I don't know the answer to that. I guess you pull the cord when you feel like you really have to.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. I mean, the software company, among the companies that I've founded, there's a software company also, and that company's still out there doing business. It didn't take off and grow the way we expected it would, the way that we needed it to justify all the money we poured into it. But that software company had a few opportunities to pivot, and we did make a couple of pivots along the way, small ones. But we had a couple of pivots to consider. And, you know, there's no, you know, bright yellow sign on the road that says, okay, time to turn left. There's not any clear indication. You just got to go with, you know, your best judgment. It's a tough call.
So tell me about when... Interesting. 4 weeks and whatnot. So when did the software company turn from solopreneur? When did the consulting, the solo consulting, turn into something more, or another company?
That next company is something that actually grew out of a men's Bible study, of all things. So a bunch of guys would get together Friday mornings way too early, 6:30 in the morning. Dude, I'm a night guy. I'm not a morning guy. So, you know, that in itself was an act of religious faith, just to show up somewhere at 6:30. Ugh. But a few times when, you know, we would get together, only two of us would be there out of the four or five, right? So at that point, we're just hanging out and having a chat. One of those times I'm talking to a guy who's, he's involved in a particular, job function. He's a commercial real estate appraiser, and, he was talking about how his job's so hard and the software's so bad. And of course, you know, I'm an engineer, so naturally I think I know all the hard stuff, right? I can handle anything hard. And, he kept on about it. You know, it's so hard. Software's so bad. One of our competitors bought the software company that we rely on. I'll tell you what you need to do. You guys need to flip the script and get in the software business. And that's where it got started. So he thought it was a terrible idea, but his partners thought it was a great idea. So we put our heads together and made a piece of software with the help of a tremendous number of people, several very accomplished, highly experienced people in this space. And I had, at one point, had a whole team of developers. I had 15 guys on a development team. Oh, my gosh, they were good. It was actually two teams running in lockstep. Agile Kanban fashion. We don't need to get into all that nerdiness, but it was quite the experience. And then I got to be there when the bottom fell out of the funding too, which was another experience. And I don't recommend that one. That one was not fun.
Well, it typically isn't. So do you have an equity stake in this company at the time of like the, you know, hey, let's all get in this together? Are you over there like, hey, yeah, sure, I'll help you, but I want to be a partner?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I had the majority stake.
Okay. And then, all right. So, wow. Okay. So they said, you've got this idea, run it, Mark, and we'll help fund it. And you said, sure. I mean, that's, yeah. I've been doing it. Why not? This is just a much bigger thing for more people. Yeah. Okay.
Put a lot of my money into it, too.
Tell me about funding. And you said, you're majority owner with a funding backing. I'm going to start to ask some detail here because I want to understand, and I want ideally people listening to understand exactly what it is you're describing. And the whirlwind that you said, you know, don't recommend it, it's not fun. I'll Probably. I agree to that. I don't know the full extent, though. So let's talk about it. What's the funding? So the other folks are helping fund this whole project because they're benefiting from it both ways. One in that you're building them in the app for them, and another in that maybe they can other people can come on.
Yeah, the principal developer actually was a friend of mine that I recruited to the effort. His name's Dan, fantastic technician, fantastic engineer. But the equity was, you know, just so much paper. There's no value to it.
Right.
But the few things that we did as a company that I thought were both correct and creative were, first, we got to version one of our product without taking any money.
Okay.
In fact, we got by on just the pocket change of the people in the original team. We knew how to do stuff on the cheap. We knew how to do stuff for free. We used an architecture for the software that was crazy new and cutting edge at the time that made it almost free to build and almost free to run. We just knew, we knew the system, the ins and the outs, and the ways to get things done. We finally started raising money after, I want to say it was year three. Yeah. And we raised some friends and family money. We got some investors from the local KC area, some angel investors from KC. And then we landed a big strategic partner. Oh my gosh, that was huge. So landing a big strategic partner that was willing not only to invest in the company, but also pay to add features to the product, man, that was fantastic. We nearly doubled the feature count in the product over the course of a year and a half. Crazy pace. Again, you know, 15 people working in lockstep, cranking features. And COVID hit. And when COVID hit, you know what that did to real estate. It did a number on our customers. Didn't do a number on us particularly. We were just collateral damage, but it did a number on our customers, and it did a number on our strategic partner. They were bleeding. They were in the red, and they went through their books and looked for things that they could cut, and we were one. And they left us holding the bag on a lot of receivables. So when they exited, they burned our cash on the way out the door. So, yeah, that hurt. That hurt pretty bad. Had to fire people. I'd never done that. That was terrible.
You'd never done that before?
I'd never done that. Nope. And now here I am, what was I, 58, 59 years old, firing my first person. Ugh. And they were dear to me. They were like family. I mean, we were such a tight squad. And they were all, you know, hand-picked. We used to kid each other all the time. We'd say, if this company sucks, it's our fault because we made all the decisions. So there's no such thing as a bad hire. There's your hire. But, oh, we had so many fine people in that team, and had to let them all go. That was a terrible day.
I'm going to be honest. I'm finding myself, like, I'm talking for the sake of, but I'm also kind of like stunned speechless because, and I understand why, you know, doing this podcast and talking to more mentors and, you know, it's my guess is it's because you hired people you trusted ultimately and more people referred in more people that were trustworthy people, right? So these are all high performing individuals, and experience tells me that high performers want to be around other high performers, right? So those are the friends that they hang out with, right? So when you say, hey, can you recommend somebody into the business, they're not going to recommend their friend that's not a high performer. Like, even if they hang out with those people, those aren't going to be the people they're going to recommend into the company. Is that safe to say? But what's stunning to me is that you could have such a high success rate.
Well, in technology, people tend to move on before they get fired.
Right.
Just, yeah, that happens in sales too. People tend to move on before they get fired. There are people who bounce through life, particularly contractors who go from one contract to the next failing. I've been blessed never to have one of those people. I've only terminated one person for cause ever. And that was actually in that software startup. And that was difficult too. But
over how many people would you say? Because it doesn't sound like, I mean, it sounds like you've hired quite a few people. This isn't a low number here.
Yeah, but, you know, honestly, it's not that hard to hire good quality people. It takes time. You can't do it in, you know, just one, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up kind of an interview. You have to get to know somebody. And I developed an interviewing practice and method over the years that has proved highly effective. But, you know, everybody I've interviewed has always said, that's the weirdest interview I've ever had.
All ears, Mark.
So I describe it as inside out, upside down. So when an employer comes to a hiring moment, the mentality is, I'm looking for a person that's going to bring something to me. I'm looking to go out and buy a person, and they will have some existing set of skills that I'm going to pay money for. And that's invariably going to be a poor experience, because it's not the skills that makes for a good teammate. And it's not the skills that makes for a good career. It's the person. So I was always looking for, I described the person that I wanted to hire as somebody who was one good break short of awesome. People who've got absolutely everything except the opportunity. Those people, however they ended up in that circumstance, those people recognize when they've got something good. They recognize when they've been given an opportunity. They recognize when you have extended your full faith and confidence in them, and they perform. They do. But to find those people, you don't sit down and say, okay, how many years of C++ do you have? How many years of Unix do you have? It's none of that. It's, what was the first piece of software you ever wrote? And what was the last piece of software you ever wrote? What are you most proud of that you've created in your career? Questions like that. What is it that you like to do in your spare time? And that's a very loaded question, because what people do in their spare time says a lot about their mind, and their attitudes. And their drive, right? What do you do in your spare time? What do you want from this job? What do you want from life in general? And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to find something in that person's life that my company can help them with. And as soon as I find that, how can I help you? Then, and show how I can help you, or I say I, how the company can help you. Once I show you how the company can help you, and by working for us, you get that help, I no longer have to motivate you. You're self-motivating. You're working for your own objectives, whatever they might be. So I align your objectives with our objectives. I tell you how we're going to help you meet yours. You come in and meet mine. It's a fantastic relationship. But it does take getting to know the person and getting past the smokescreen of skills. You can teach people anything except how to be nice and how to be smart.
How do you find you're getting to the truth?
Dad was a really good card player.
And because of that, he was a really good judge of people, verbally and nonverbally. I think part of that is gift and part of it is skill. And I have a good BS detector. That comes from knowing a little about a lot. So there aren't many subjects where I'm completely unprepared and completely ignorant. So I just listen to the way people waltz through a conversation. And if I get the opinion that they are in some way being deceptive, that, you know, that raises my hackles. And, you know, people do that pretty often. But people are at their most genuine when they are relating stories about their own life-changing moments. So to find out about life-changing moments takes conversation. And it usually happens over dinner, beer, or both. So a few of my interviews actually started out with, hey, let's go grab a beer. Wasn't an interview that anybody knew except me. And, you know, ultimately ended up making job offers. So that kind of stuff happens too. But how do you know when you're getting to the truth? People reveal themselves in conversation in moments of heightened emotion. So get to the heightened emotion, whether it's, you know, happy, sad, excited, angry, whatever it might be, get to the height of emotion and you'll get to the truth. Huh.
So tell me about that day when you had to fire all your friends.
Oh my gosh. Oh, it was terrible. It was terrible. So we found out on a Friday. Actually, it was on a Thursday. We found out on a Thursday, cord was cut, contract was severed, money was shut off. We were left holding seven figures of receivables that we were not going to get paid for. So there went the cash. And then we realized.
Oh, yeah, my goodness. I'm realizing you said receivables, not payables, receivables. So yep. I thought when you first said it, you said like they took the payables with you, like your ability to pay debtor. How are they taking the receivables with them? Help.
They owed us money for pro services, which is what was funding that team of 15 people. And they
That's
were being presented. Yeah, they were presented regular bills, and there was a bill for seven figures.
Okay.
They did. Yeah. And
so the company funding you is also buying from you. Which, yes. I mean, I guess this makes sense. This isn't necessarily what I would call too abnormal, except for they stop paying you at some point. And, okay, we're going to have to rewind a little bit. Where was there ever concern?
Concern that we might lose them as a partner?
Well, I mean, they're not paying their... When did they stop paying their bill and for how long? Or was that just, you know, last month's bill? Not a big deal. They're on a net 30 anyway. Like, help me out here with that mindset.
There were invoices that were dragging and hadn't been paid. And there were recently presented invoices that needed to be paid. And you sum it up and it's got two commas in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Ow. But right. Yeah. But I guess what I'm asking is, even before this point, was there ever a moment of like, oh my God, guys, you know, if we lose our strategic partner, we also lose. And then it's all like, we need to diversify or something.
Yeah. So we did have other customers.
Okay.
But the strategic partner was an order of magnitude more revenue.
Sure.
So the strategic partner was funding our growth. Our great concern was that we would lose our engine for growth, not that we would lose our ability to execute within the company.
Yeah. I understand.
No, nobody saw a complete cessation in the cards. Nobody saw sure. COVID coming. Nobody right. saw the complete collapse of real estate. Couldn't see it coming.
So let's start to get timeline on here since COVID is fresh in everybody's mind, I'm sure, if we bother to relive that nightmare. So that's March, right? End of March into April. I think April. I think I've got it slightly back. I can't remember if March or April, thank God, because I'm trying to forget, was the month that, like, it didn't matter how conservative, how liberal, it didn't matter up, down, left, right, sideways. There was a solid month where the whole world just kind of stopped there for a second. Important, not important. We didn't know what we were dealing with. Everybody shut down. I know this because I started back up the month later and everybody else thought I was crazy, but I was solopreneur at the time and I needed food on the table. And I tell you what, right. People, you learn the hard, like there were a few people that told me I was crazy, including a coach at the time. And I'm like, well, I have starvation, which is a very literal threat, or a, pandemic, which hasn't yet manifested itself as a real threat. So I'm going to go ahead and pick the starvation. Where in that lag, so that's March, April of 2020, where in there is Strategic Partners? Like you said, it was a day. You said it was a Friday.
I
don't need the exact date here. Just I'm trying to decide. Late June, Jeff.
Yeah.
Okay, so we made it to June. Wow. Okay. All right. Yeah. That sounds exactly right. Fair. So we've made it one whole month where the world stood still into the month where things really haven't started yet. Not for anybody with funding. I mean, the scrappy guys like me maybe are out on the streets again, but not anybody normal. I know this because I had a contracting gig and they handed me a piece of paper that literally was like, I'm an important, like I'm a necessary. They're like, in case you get pulled over, use this.
Right. It's my hall pass.
Yeah. So, okay. So that's fair. So your strategic partner pulls out. It's on a Friday. Yeah. What? Wow. For some reason, I really want to get into this space, like physically and mentally. So everybody's wearing a mask probably or whatever, because it's June of 2020. And you're going to have to fire people.
Well, we ran the company virtually, both the infrastructure and the work environment. Everything was virtual. Everything was remote.
Long before that point.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Because that's cheap, right? If you've got office space, that's very expensive and it does not increase productivity whatsoever.
And you guys were scrappy in your first 3 years.
That's
so
right.
So why change things now? And you've hired people that are trustworthy. That are A players that want to get the mission achieved. All right,
right.
I'm getting in the mindset now. We're there. It's beautiful.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
It's Friday.
We're locked and loaded. Yeah.
Right. And you really, I mean, other than strategic, if the economy hadn't have stopped, you guys could have, like, I mean, there it would have not touched you from a business because you're all working virtually, had long before. You're on a growth trajectory. You have trustworthy people. You're not having to figure out the remote infrastructure. While the rest of the world was like, what is Zoom? You guys were probably over there, Teams, Google Workspace, whatever it is. You're chatting back and forth like it's nothing.
Because we're a bunch of technologists, right?
So, right.
You know, we would. You know, whoever had the cool tool of the month. Yeah, we had many of those little ad hoc conversations, like what have you been using lately that's really cool, and you learn a lot of new stuff that way, a lot of interesting stuff, and we had all the confidence in the world that we were delivering a very good product for a very happy customer, and that customer, being one of the largest in the country, if not the planet, was going to give us a whole lot of halo, a whole lot of cachet with new prospects. My gosh, you go from flying high to absolutely grinding your chin on the pavement. And have to make that call, get your team together on a big Zoom call Monday morning and just tell them, this is what happened. They withdrew all the money. They're not paying us for anything else. We got your payroll covered, and that's the best that we can do.
We did give people some days of additional runway. I want to say it was another 2 weeks, which was more than we could afford, but we did. And it was hard for some of them. They really struggled. We put them into a job market that at the time was not great. It was a whole lot better than it is now. But it wasn't great, and it wasn't great for a while. It weighed on me. I watched the guys on LinkedIn to see, you know, when they got jobs. I saw notifications for some, you know, happy to announce, you know, starting a new job, all of that stuff. And some of them called me back every few months and said, I still haven't found anything. And that was so, so hard to hear. But there was nothing that I could do. There was nothing that any of us could do. We weren't in a circumstance, and we didn't have the means to make it anything other than it was, which is, you know, a big retraction in the company.
Yeah, yep. That's.
But I can say through that company, we created careers for a number of people where they had none. We did find those people who were one good break short of awesome and let them become awesome. Our first hire actually was a person, I didn't know it at the time, but our first hire was a person who was on food stamps. I didn't know. I knew they really needed a job, and I knew they'd be special for us, and we hired them, and then... You know, they were with us for several years and then went on to have a great career in other automation technology. HubSpot, you know, became a HubSpot genius and went off and, you know, started a HubSpot career. Fantastic. And, you know, I got a sack full of those stories. So, you know, maybe the company didn't take off, but we sure launched some careers. And that was cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. Warren Buffett says, and I'm going to mess this up a little bit, but I don't think by much. It's kind of close at heart for a relatively recent thing where he says you need to hire people that are intelligent, hardworking, and trustworthy. And if they don't have the last one, then the first two are toxic. Integrity. Yep. That's what it was. Intelligence. Hardworking and integrity, and if they don't have the last one, the first two are toxic. But it is an interesting thing because, the interesting thing that, like, it sounds so simple, right? And this is what I'm kind of trying to get from you that I don't know if I've quite gotten yet. I'm looking for like a formula, like a magic sauce, and what I'm hearing is like, you know, try and get to the bottom of who they are, which I agree. But how hard is that, really? Right? I mean, you're talking. Lots of long conversation and you know, invoking emotion, perfect world. You've got some maybe deep stories in there that kind of start to pull some of that out. And then maybe that's how you ask them, you know, hey, how'd you lose the last gig or, you know, whatever. I don't know, but these aren't traditional interview tactics either though, necessarily.
No.
And I'm sure there's some HR people out there that are screaming at the TV like, what are you doing? You cannot ask them about that. But also like...
None of it was recorded, so you can't prove I asked anything.
Sure. Right. And I'm not trying to, by the way.
But it's just a conversation. In fact, I had one person ask, so when are we starting the interview? And I said, we just finished it. Which was, we had a really good laugh. Like, you didn't even know it was going down, did you? But it's about the third point, integrity, character. You want someone of good character. You want someone who is intelligent, but, you know, not exceedingly so. You don't have to be, you know, some chess playing super genius. But you do need to be fairly intelligent in technology. You need to be smart in a particular way. So, especially in software, you know, we consider ourselves or call ourselves a special kind of idiot. Not
not just any old person off the street could make a career in software. And people often choose software for the salary. And if you do that for the salary and not for a fascination or an obsession or a passion, you will not thrive. You'll probably go do something else because it's a cruel mistress. A software career is a cruel mistress.
That's a beautiful way of putting that. Because from a tech side, so from a non-software, more like systems engineer side, some of my favorite words are, well, the lab at home. I'm like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah. See, that's in your spare time. What do? The lab at home, you're hired.
Yeah.
Not quite that easy, but.
But it's close. It's not far off. It's not far off. If I hear a lab at home, I'm kind of leaping out of my seat because it is. It's a cruel mistress, and it's and you do have to have something of a fascination. It's an interesting thing too, because I don't think any of us are slave drivers. That's not the point. The point is just that, okay, Sam, SAP, that's a really cool technology. What does it do and why does it matter and why is it applicable? We don't have time to futz with that. I mean, we're lucky if we do, but there's a good possibility that you'll maybe get an hour a week. That's not long enough to futz with a brand new emergent technology, right? So Sam is going to have to go home. Well, he doesn't. It's not like it's discussed. It's not outright. But if Sam really wants to move the needle and Sam's really interested in this new emergent technology, then I'm going to have to go home and play with it in the lab. And that's really the only way that the needle truly gets moved forward. And the only way Sam does that at all is if he's remotely interested, truly interested in the technology.
It has to capture your imagination. It has to capture your passion. Because if it doesn't, as you pointed out, technology is constantly moving.
Yeah.
And a software career is a career of change. It's a career of self-education because the stuff you started using 5 years ago is not the stuff you're using today. Or if it is, then you're on a rapid path to obsolescence. You have to continually educate yourself. You have to continually grow in your skills and abilities. Otherwise, you're eventually going to end up getting laid off. Those kinds of things happened to people a lot in the 80s and 90s. They grew up with mainframe technology. The old IBM, Big Iron, basement of the building kind of computing facilities. And that technology was quickly, I wouldn't say replaced, but outshined by distributed computing and networked computing and all the rest of this cool stuff, right? If you didn't pursue those changes in the industry, then you eventually ended up being, the old guy over in the corner who's the only one who can remember how the mainframe works, if you were lucky, because there were, probably 15 guys just like that one who got laid off because they just didn't need people who knew that old thing anymore, and nobody else would hire them. That was the awful part, is that skills that people built up over decades, they found out were not particularly valuable or not valued in the same way, and it became hard to get jobs. I saw people who, they'd take the package, so to speak. They take the early retirement package thinking, I'm getting a year of salary. I'm going to put it in the bank and I'm going to go out and get me another job. Well, 14 months later, when you don't have another job and you burned all that money, that's a very unfortunate time to find out you're no longer marketable. So if you want to stay marketable, you better be teaching yourself. And the only way you're going to effectively teach yourself over a lifetime is if it has captured your passion. It's like golf. Nobody just casually plays golf. You might go out and whack a ball a few times. You're not really playing golf. You're drinking beer in a cart. But if you really want to play golf, it's a lifetime pursuit.
and you'll never be great at it. You'll just continue to get better. Software is the same way. If you're going to be good at it, you have to be continually getting good at it. Got to stay with it. Got to work on your short game and work on your distributed computing skills.
So we're about to get really depressing really fast because I want to talk about AI now, Mark. And normally I'm not depressing. Normally I'm more optimistic when it comes to AI. But here's why I think this is going to get depressing. Because you're talking about the old age, you're talking about the antiquated, you're talking about the, and you're talking to, I did have a lab, I've always been a fan of like, what's the big new shiny thing, right? And then with the SaaS world and with people realizing they could 10x their return if they got lucky, you know, we got venture capital companies just pumping money into this thing. So you got app after app after app after app. But for the most part, you can kind of keep a hold of the emergent ones, right? Eventually, they capture enough market share that now you're looking at it. You're like, okay, let's track it, right? But you're kind of keeping up with it. I was an early adopter of ChatGPT and AI. And Mark, I am floored at the rate, not just of the feature, the release, and how quickly this thing is evolving. Like when it started, I saw its value and I was like, this is cool. And it has, and was like, this is cool. This is valuable. This is a new tool. We're going to adopt it. We're going to lean into it. And that was in 23. The pace at which this thing has morphed into a point to where I am making fun conversations with people of like, yeah, we really don't know what sentience is. And frankly, if I'm being honest, I think whenever we finally figure out this thing is sentient, it will have been that way for long before we notice it.
That's a possibility, yeah.
Yeah, and so, but never mind that. That's one half, right? The second half is Microsoft, Amazon, Google, Facebook, Meta are pouring such mass sums of money from places that God knows where, that apparently they have, into manufacturing large data centers. We're now seeing where, you know, data centers are springing up as if they were like out of the box mobile homes,
right,
in mass. And if they're not already sprung up, there's like another two or three on the back burner that have been like pre-purchased, pre-planned, pre-ready to go. And I saw a short that I feel like recently that I feel like really captured this, where it was like the concern is we'll hit a singularity in where the pace that we understand not only this thing, but the features that this thing is capable of figuring out. You know, imagine a world where AI is now developing itself, right? And it's developing the next app and it's developing the next, you know, we're not there yet. Thank goodness. But we enter this like cyclical cycle, right? Where it's self-improving now. Well, its rate of self-improvement, and the example given, I think, was relatively elegant. You have a new iPhone every 2 to 3 years, right? We can keep up with that. We can buy the new iPhone. I'm always the person that's like an iPhone or two behind, frankly. But you can keep up with that. And an iPhone or two behind is not really a problem, right? It's never really been a problem. Okay, well, now we have a new iPhone every month. Well, now we have a new iPhone every day. Now we have a new iPhone every 5 minutes. You can't, and you look at it and it's so vastly different than it was before. You can't keep up with that. So is there a concern in your mind for that happening? And what's wild to me is, are you seeing like the rapid change in AI? I don't know. I'm baffled. I'm in a world where I'm optimistic. I think I'll always be an optimist because otherwise, well, the extreme is pessimist, just isn't any fun. but I am seeing where ChatGPT is the most rapidly developed app I think I've ever encountered. Let's put it that way. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, it's a whole body of technology, right?
Right.
So when the large language model, you know, in my experience, just emerged from nowhere, I didn't see it coming. When the large language model emerged, it completely stomped out all of the illusions I had about machine learning and AI to that point. I mean, I took some courses, I built some deep neural networks with Python and libraries like TensorFlow. So I knew how to build little ones. I didn't know how to build 3 billion input LLMs. It breaks my brain. I don't even know what that is. But the absolute revolutionary, unimaginable leap with LLM technology was really the spark that started the fire. And we're just reapplying LLMs at this point, improving on that technology. So, you know, from agriculture to industry, to automobiles, to electricity, smartphones, personal computers, air conditioning. I mean, all of these technological changes and advancements in the moment are surprising, and they are culture changing. This is going to change our culture in a big way. And some of it's not going to be so cool. For the people who understand it and can leverage it, it's fantastic. But we're creating another chasm between the haves and the have-nots. It used to just be money, and then education and money. Now it's going to be technology. If I know how to use this technology for my benefit, I could do quite well. I could make a lot of money. I could do a lot of good. But it's not for everybody. I don't know how we make it okay for everybody. I don't know how we make it okay for all the kids who got marketing degrees. I don't know. All the kids who got journalism degrees. I don't know. It's gonna have to be something else, right? All the people who, not out of passion, but out of pursuit of money, became software developers. I'm sorry, you guys are all toast. It's only an elite crew, and I don't mean that in an arrogant way. It's just there will be a niche of people who will make this technology particularly effective. And many of those who had been involved in the previous generation of technological accomplishment will not be able to stay on for the ride. It's going to be tough. I no longer advise people to get a degree in software engineering or computer science. I can tell you that.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. To that end, I'm seeing more and more people with beautiful degrees and even pedigrees and you know, entering the market and then looking around, and it's specifically with software in particular, it's difficult right now. I think, you know, in our space, I think we've kind of managed to miss it because we never were developers. We were implementers. You know, we're software implementation and support basically is what it boils down to it, if I was to sum it up in a technical frame. And you know, understanding industry standard software and then implementing that, but it's a fascinating thing to see, and it's a jarring thing, because I think the other thing, well, there's two facets here. Somebody said it the other day, you know, AI is the world of the one-eyed man. You know, where everyone else is blind. And then what was so fascinating when he said that was, I was like, what's wild to me too is I've met two-eyed people in the world of the one-eyed man, but they don't know what to do. So they just stand there looking foolish. And he's like, that's the problem. They've got too much input. And so, you know, so everybody's looking around each other, and this, you know, I keep recounting, there's an article, this is like a 10-year-old article. I'll have to redig it up. But I keep recounting, you know, back in the day, Google implemented an early AI. They basically, it was an LLM model or whatever you want to call it, where they were like, look, we recognize that going from English to Spanish and Spanish to French and French to Russian, like, this is not an effective way of translation. Wouldn't it be nice to have this middle language that the computer can use to streamline translations between languages, the universal language, right? And they took this AI model and they basically said, do that. We don't even care. Like, just do that. And sure enough, the thing generated a language that nobody could understand. When you looked at it on its face, not a single person could understand. Like, they couldn't read it. But, and this is the thing about AI, you can measure the input and you can measure the output, right? As long as the translations match up, it doesn't matter what language is sitting there in the middle. They just need to match up. And so we're in this weird world where, A, the more you know, like, if you know just a little bit about it, you know more than the people that are already profiting on it, frankly. And then the second interesting thing is nobody really knows everything about it. And I don't think we can, and I, at the pace that it's progressing, I don't think we ever will. And that's kind of the, hopefully it doesn't veer out of control. But again, we come into measurable inputs and measurable outputs, like which is AI, is large language models, is machine learning, what you're talking about, this world where we kind of skip the middle bit. But how big will that middle bit get, I guess, is the... Anyway, so catching up. Okay, so your company, the software company, you have a controlling interest. You've had to let a lot of people go now. Do you have enough customers to make do? When do you pivot from that? And is that pivot into this, or is there something else in the middle?
No, my pivot was, I'm done with this. I'm going to go do something else.
Smack dab in the middle of COVID. You did it. That was June, and you did it in July.
No, that was just last year. Yeah, that was my eventual pivot. I got other stuff to work on, right? I mean, I've got this family business, and I've got my own practice, and I've been busting my butt and pouring my hard-earned money into that company for, well, since 2015. And at a certain point, you just got to say, I'm pulling the ripcord on this thing. And I'm going to do something else. There are still ways to pivot that company that could be particularly successful and lucrative. There are ways. They have another leadership team now, and they've got a plan. I'm sure they'll be successful.
Good.
I'm on to my new thing. Family business. Create something a little bit larger to hand off to the kids.
Podcast.
It might. But I will say that a lot of my attitudes and a lot of my practices and approaches are shaped by my Christian worldview. Mm-hmm. And it's very simple. I mean, I'm not a complicated guy when it comes to my religious beliefs. It's really pretty simple, and it's put me in a good place in leading people and in helping people, because essentially leadership is helping people to achieve their own end goals and to succeed according to their own terms. But the bedrock of my decision-making process is the bedrock of my business thinking and actions is my Christian faith. It is Christ. And, I don't try to make a big deal out of that, but, it is important to know that about me. If you really want to figure me out, that's step one.
Well, the golden rule is a beautiful way to hire and let go if you have to, right?
Yeah. Do unto others. There are a few others. I'll paraphrase. I think it was Paul when he said, if I have the means to help and I don't do it, then that is sin. Whew, that's a tough one.
That's a tough one. Because you got to draw a box around that, right? Nevertheless, withholding help is a sin. I flip that and I say, helping is doing good. And helping with no expectation of return is best. And that's the, you know, that's the casting the bread upon the waters metaphor. You cast it, not expecting or knowing that it will come back, but it does. And that way of interacting with others, that way of dealing with others, giving with no expectation of receiving, is a powerful tool in building successful human relationships and networks. It is powerful because when people see that you're helping them and there's no other shoe that's going to drop, you're not saying, oh, and give me this. Oh, and buy my that. It's like, is there anything else I can do for you? No? Okay, have a good one. See ya. When people encounter that, it's very disarming. But at the same time, it quickly builds trust. It quickly builds it reinforces one's integrity in the community. You know, people recognize and realize the kind of person that you are. It matters. It makes a big difference. So being a Christian has helped me quite a bit in leadership. It's made me very effective in leadership. And it's helped to simplify for me a lot of the things in leadership that can be confusing or complicated if you don't have a framework that helps to inform your actions. It's a playbook. You know, I don't have to figure out half the plays in my life because I've already got a playbook, right? It's easy. There are some hard parts, and you have to, as the scriptures tell us, use what's given to you, the scriptures, the indwelling Holy Spirit, your own natural intelligence, the wise counsel of those around you. Those are all your inputs, right? But there are still circumstances that show up that can be really hard. And you gotta keep an open mind, but you've got to keep one toe back in your foundation, right? You don't want to leave your foundation. So here's one. I don't know how real we want to make this. Here's one. A technologist, a programmer, was introduced to me. Looked good on paper. And the recruiter said, I just want you to know, this person is actually transitioning to female. I'm like, well, that'll be an interesting conversation. Okay. The funny thing is in that conversation, in that interview, she asked me, you know, some things about myself, and I was kind of tipping my hand that I'm a Christian person. And she said, so Christian person, this has got to be an awkward conversation for you then. And I asked, well, why is that? She said, well, you know, Christians aren't really big on trans. And I said, you know, I don't think you really know who Jesus was. I mean, you know, Jesus was, he was having dinner with, you know, with prostitutes and tax collectors. His associations were, by the highbrow standards, probably pretty sketchy, and he got called out for it, right? But just because somebody's different doesn't mean that that they should be shunned or isolated. Quite the contrary. You know, we need to get to know one another. We need to get in close, appreciate our strengths, weaknesses, similarities, differences, because. And this was one of the things we put in our employee handbook. We're better when we work together, and we're better when we're different from each other. It was great. And I'd like to think that I was being very broad-minded in that hire. But it's just because you're using a Christian foundation doesn't mean that's all you use or that is enough. I mean, if you're looking strictly at Scripture, maybe you'd say, I shouldn't hire a person who is so different from me. Maybe. I don't know. That's not me. I don't think that's who the Lord was. That's not how Jesus lived. So I'd rather err on the side of loving and accepting everybody. Certainly not hating on each other. My goodness, we got to stop that.
Yeah, it's wild how applicable that is. Because, you know, you think of Jesus, it's made pretty clear that he was popular, you know, and I'm specifically using that because part of the reason he got so much criticism, I mean, you don't get that much criticism, right, without a degree of popularity. And what's coming through my mind specifically is the moment when he was having dinner with the tax collector, which at the time the tax collectors were, it's my understanding that they were being used by the Romans, by the church even. It was kind of multifaceted, the word I want to use, I'll get there, almost like a desecration, leveraging the tax collectors in a way that to take from the people. And so they really weren't viewed highly. And I'm, wish I could remember which gospel it was, probably multiple of them, but you know, Jesus is having dinner with them and the Pharisees and the Sadducees notice it, right? Not mm-hmm. just that he's having dinner with them, it's that they notice it, they see through the window or whatever, and that's he's criticized for it. But to your point, it is such an interesting thing that I know what you mean. Like I understand in that maybe I've been in maybe even similar situations, and sometimes you get criticism even from other believers that are like, oh, well, wait a minute.
I did.
What are you doing?
I did.
But I don't know. So? It would take forever to unpack that.
Yeah. Criticize me all you want. I'm still going to do what I think is right. And
what I like your point exactly, because it's the same boat for me. Like if you were to look at the team, I kind of make the joke that we look a little ragtag, not because of anything about us, but just because it's like it's almost like it's this collection of misfits that just know how to fight, I guess, and work hard and pull together, and something about that is just beautiful. And I wouldn't want it any other way. I wouldn't want it any other way than to look and be like, this is really cool, this team, because I know their backstory and their backstory and their backstory, and none of it is I grew up in this field and I just loved it. And I, you know, my dad mentored me and my mom, and I went to college and I came out and I just been doing it since I was a baby. None of it is any of that.
Well, I learned from my dad that you reinvent yourself after every several years. You know, you don't finish playing the same game that you started. So for me, it started out as a programmer working on, I made the software that delivered the video for the Seoul Olympics. That was my first thing. It's like, who gives anybody a first job out of school that kind of responsibility? That was nuts. But it was a different time. Programmers were rare and they were exceptional, and they gave you a lot of cool jobs that honestly nowadays as a new hire, you'd never see. Yeah, I forgot where I was going with this, but the thing about my career has been the number of times I've reinvented. So, went from a programmer to a user experience designer back before we knew what those were, an application architect and designer, and there wasn't such a thing at the time. But that was the job function. And, you know, gone from there to, you know, small business owner and operator in a couple of ways, founded a startup. Now I'm in this, you know, new era of life where I'm running the family business. I mean,
there have been changes all along the way. You never finish the way you start. And planning for that can only get you so far. I mean, my dad did everything from, he worked for NASA, he worked for U.S. Army Missile Command, he worked for the Department of Energy at a nuclear plant. He worked at a place that made chain link fence. He worked at a place that made conveyor belts. He built houses. He ran this company. He restored and sold heavy equipment. I mean, he had a million things going on, far more than I do. I had a real estate company, for goodness sake. Where does all this come from? But Dad could grind. He was a grinder. He was the number six of seven kids that survived. There were nine. Two of them died before the age of one. Tiny little house in North Alabama. Dad was a sharecropper, which I guess that's not a thing anymore. But his dad was a sharecropper, and my dad, I think he said he never owned a new pair of shoes as a child. He only got his older brother's shoes. He got the older kid's clothes. He rode a bicycle and he couldn't reach both pedals at the same time. I saw that bicycle. They still had it. Oh my gosh, it was a rusty Hulk. But Dad grew up without. He picked cotton for spending money. You know, he grew up without. And he knew if he wanted to have anything, he was going to have to work really, really hard. And he worked really, really hard so that his kids could have more and better and wouldn't have to work as hard. So shout out to Dad. Dad's where it all started. That was it.
All right. So before you and I started talking, you made it a shout out to your pen. I told you I would loop back to it. And here we go. And the reason he said, so you had the pen and you said, it's an homage to engineers everywhere.
Mechanical pencil. Let me get it in the camera. Mechanical pencil. Go. I don't carry pens.
Okay. My bad. Sorry.
Engineers don't do anything permanent. So it's a mechanical pencil, and I've rocked a mechanical pencil since I was in school. But the reason I still carry it is because it's a totem. It's a thing that I use to remember.
Well, hold that thought.
Yeah.
Because the question is, if we have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. And it is in the same way exactly, an homage to those who've come before us that have built what we stand on today.
Right.
Who's been a giant in your life, Mark, that you wish to be homage to?
Well, my grandfather, my mother's father. So he grew up in an age of, this was, you know, even before, industrial automation of any sort. I mean, you know, his life experience was horse and mule and ox and all the rest of that stuff, subsistence farming but he saw an opportunity to have a trade and a career and provide for a family by becoming a master electrician. So he went off to what they called electrical school at Alabama Polytechnic, and he got his certificate as a master electrician from the electrical school there. Well, guess what Alabama Polytechnic grew up to be? Auburn. So Alabama Polytechnic changed its name to Auburn, and all the men in my family have gone to school there. And my dad graduated there. And you know, my uncle went, my cousin went, my nephew's there. I mean, and it's an engineering school. It's not just that it's Auburn, loveliest village on the plain, beautiful place. You should go. But it's not just that it is Auburn. It is opportunity. It is,
it is where everything started for me, both in terms of family history and in my own pursuits. So yeah, it was my grandfather, I'd say. There were many ways to get something done, but there was only one good way. And he would always show you the good way. And he always had a way. I mean, everything. He had a way. I guess when you're, 60, 70 years old, gosh, that's me. I guess by the time you get that old, you do have a way for pretty much anything. But that guy could really solve a lot of problems very simply. He was, as he described himself, he was a jackleg mechanic, which is, I think that kind of means like half-assed.
So
he was pretty handy.
That brings me to my second question, which is, if there was a pithy saying or general rule of thumb that you personally in your life has found to be true again and again and again, that kind of helps guide you, what would it be?
I'm trying to think.
These would be sayings like, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs, or, statements like those that just like, so true.
So much of my life is really wrapped up in doing good for others and letting that be its own reward. But but fundamentally it grows out of, Jesus' summarization of the commandments, which is to love God and man. That's all I want to do. And that dictates a lot of my decisions in the moment. I mean, sometimes I end up, I wonder, am I just that gullible rube that everybody takes advantage of because I'm tenderhearted and because I give with no expectation of getting, because I don't try to pick apart somebody's motive when they express a need? Yeah, maybe, but I still like me this way. I wouldn't like me as the, as a cold, uncaring, turn my eyes away kind of person. And when I see that in myself, I have a little internal conversation and scold myself and then go do the thing I talk myself out of. I actually had that happen to me. I was running late to get to my daughter's house, and I had to stop and get some gas. Well, I wheeled into the gas station, and here comes, it happens all the time, right? There's some lady with a sad story, and she walks up, can you just buy me a this? I got to go do a that. And So the busy, self-centered, selfish Mark said, I'm sorry, no. I don't have any money, no. I can't help you, no. And then I looked at her face, and her face told me she wasn't trying to trick me. Yeah. Her face told me she was genuinely chagrined and worried. I could see it.
Yeah.
Something was wrong. It wasn't a scam. So I scolded myself. I went over, and it was kind of disarming, I guess. I went over and I put my arm around her and I said, come over here and let's go get you taken care of. And pumped her car full of gas and sent her on her way. And she was saying, I got to get to the doctor. I'm like, yeah, everybody says that.
Yeah.
But then as she was leaving, I noticed she had on hospital socks.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, she did need it. Give with no expectation of getting, I guess is how that works out for me. It's not just do unto others, but it's give with no expectation of getting. And Gary Vaynerchuk will say that. He'll throw more F-bombs in it, but he says that. Yeah.
Man's pulling out Gary Vaynerchuk too. Let's go.
Yeah, that's one of his pithy observations, and it's a personal philosophy of his. I didn't pick it up from him, but I really did appreciate the support on that point.
Thank you so much for being with me today, Mark. This has meant a lot.
No, it's my pleasure, Sam. I look forward to hanging out and talking some more sometime. It's been great.
Oh, we're gonna. Bye, everybody.
Thanks. See ya.
Hello, everyone. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.